This is the third day of this June 2012 six-day session. Well, we'll resume reading from the letters of the 11th century Chinese Zen master Yuan Wu. This is from a book called Zen Letters. He begins this letter, "By even speaking a phrase to you, I have already doused you with dirty water. It would be even worse for me to put a twinkle in my eye and raise my eyebrow to you, or rap on the meditation seat, or hold up a whisk, or demand, 'What is this?' As for shouting and hitting, it's obvious that this is just a pile of bones on level ground. So, point being that no expression of it can be it completely. Certainly not in words. By even speaking a phrase to you, I've already doused you with dirty water. This is the feeling I've had so often as just beginning a teisho. It's such a shame in a way to talk about Zen. Misses the whole point in one way, and yet there's hardly ever been a teacher in the history of Zen who hasn't used words and given talks. This is puts it in the realm of expedient means. It's not the thing itself, but it points to it. It's the finger pointing to the moon. Sometimes we've got to point to the moon to get people to see it. This morning with the rain, I told Errol to... We needed to postpone the teisho for half an hour because no, not even my best teisho could compete with rain as a presentation of the Dharma. It's also a problem with hearing. It's getting pretty loud there this morning. If we think of an oral presentation of the Dharma, then we're surrounded by it, especially in the summer months when we have the windows open. We have all of these bird sounds and other sounds, surround sound. But there's a place for words too. He goes on, "There are also the type who don't know good from bad and ask questions about Buddha and Dharma and Zen and the Tao. They ask to be helped. They beg to be received. They seek knowledge and sayings and theories relating to the Buddhist teaching and to transcending the world and to accommodating the world. This is washing dirt in mud and washing mud in dirt. When will they ever manage to clear it away?" There's a story that Roshi Kapil told two or three times in Teisho about a high-strung New Yorker who goes up to Vermont and stops in at a general store, and there are some old-timers sitting around, and he tries making conversation with them, kind of a lame attempt to make conversation with them, and he got more agitated as he got little response from them, and finally he said, what's wrong up here? How can someone get people to talk? And one of these old timers who is probably whittling at a piece of wood said, "Well, we got a saying up here. If you can't improve on silence, you better stay quiet." It's a daunting prospect. How do we improve on silence? It's all there. Continues, "So we know that you must be someone genuinely within the tradition before you can be fully familiar with the fundamental portion of the vehicle of the school that has come down from time immemorial. If you really have an entry into enlightenment, then you know when to start and when to stop, when to advance and when to withdraw, and you can distinguish what is permissible from what is not." This last phrase, "you can distinguish what is permissible from what is not," it speaks to our native sense of right and wrong, or maybe better to put it in terms of what is harmful to others and what is not. When we are causing harm and when we're not. In Buddhism, we have these precepts that articulate this in a more traditional, formal way. But they are meant to just articulate what we know in our heart of hearts, what we need to be reminded of sometimes, because we so readily look for rationalization for reasons to get around conduct that is wholesome, doesn't cause harm to others. So the precepts are a way of closing off that avenue of escape. You know when to start and when to stop, when to advance and when to withdraw. When we're free of thoughts, or relatively free of thoughts, then we don't get caught in these dilemmas of, should I go to Doksan? Should I not go to Doksan? Should I stay up to sit more or should I not? Should I go to bed? When we're free of conceptualizing about these things and trafficking in notions of what we should be doing and we shouldn't be doing, then we know how to respond. But this is no small thing to be free of thoughts. And with regard to silence, we can also be attached to silence. It's not really whether we're using words or not, but where the words come from, whether they're coming from just the conceptual mind, or whether it's from someplace deeper than that. Leaving behind all leakages, day by day you get closer to the truth and more familiar with it. As you go further, you change like a panther who no longer sticks to its den. You leap out of the corral. Then you no longer doubt all the sayings of the world's enlightened teachers. You are like cast iron. This is precisely the time to apply effort and cultivate practice and nourish your realization. Notice this is clearly, he means after realization. This is the time to apply effort and cultivate practice. The real value of awakening in the big picture is that it establishes faith on an experiential level. Now you know. You're not just believing these teachings, but you have confirmed them without question. And it's from that place of experiential knowing that we can work more effectively. That's really the main benefit of awakening. We're less susceptible to doubts. There can still be doubts after an initial faint awakening, but the deeper it is, the more we are free of them. And that's when we can really go to town. Leakages. This is a Chinese Zen word. Refers to sometimes it's called the outflows. This is where, basically in Zen terms, where the mind is just running into thoughts and away from the bare attention that we're cultivating in practice. After that, you can kindle the inexhaustible lamp and travel the unobstructed path. You relinquish your body and your life to rescue living beings. You enable them to come out of their cages and eliminate their attachments and bonds. He's talking here about teaching. You cure them of the diseases of being attached to being enlightened, so that having emerged from the deep pit of liberation, they can become uncontrived, unencumbered, joyfully alive people of the path. He's warning here in an oblique way. He's warning about the sickness, what Zen calls a sickness, that can come over one after awakening, where one thinks of oneself as something special. This is counterintuitive. How can you see through the self and other, and still think of yourself as special? But there are this deep conditioning that doesn't yield its habit forces even through a genuine awakening experience. There's a lag where we still, this egocentric tendencies can still get a hold of us. That's the deep pit of liberation, any attachment to the idea of having attained anything. And then to really cleanse oneself of any such notions leaves us uncontrived, unencumbered, joyfully alive people. When you yourself have crossed over, you must not abandon the carrying out of your bodhisattva vows. You must be mindful of liberating all beings and steadfastly endure the attendant hardship and toil in order to serve as a boat on the ocean of all knowledge. Only then will you have some accord with the path. So we're not really in accord with this way, this Tao, so long as we are doing this practice for ourselves alone, so long as we begrudge helping others, serving others. then we're not really, our practice is not mature. This too is a pretty advanced state where we don't begrudge being a monitor or being a head cook or giving up time in the zendo to work to help others in sesshin or outside of sesshin. But so long as we cling to the notion of practice as just our private thing that we can do undisturbed by others, then we have certainly further to go. The truth is that giving in those ways, giving up of one's, let's say, one's preferences, that itself is a way to develop oneself. It's a way to hasten one's awakening. We give up these ideas of my practice. What is this my practice? If practice means anything, it means all of us together. Some of you have heard me tell the story of way back in the early 70s when the Doksan rushes were more competitive and even a little over the top, everyone trying to beat out everyone else to get to Doksan. And there was this one time when there was a collision at the entryway where people were coming from different sides, the side aisles of the zendo, and they crashed. There was a big pile up, and one woman, just about the maybe the one or the only one or two people at the time who had a kensho, she stopped in her own running to Doksan and with a signal, a quick signal, she enlisted the help of a Dharma sister, and together this one hapless fellow who had fallen on his face in the aisle, and they each took one elbow and lifted him off the floor and helped him get back on the way. It's of course anyone can do this from the idea of, well, this is the right thing, this is the virtuous thing, I should stop and help this person. But I think what was really unusual about this incident was that the woman, there was no hesitation, just bang, like that, stopping, picking up. That was she who fell down on the floor at that moment. No separation between herself and him. And then just one last warning here about clinging to one's, whatever one thinks one has attained. He says, don't be a brittle pillar or a feeble lamp. Don't bat around your little clean ball of inner mystical experience. Who doesn't see a cat when you hear those words? You may have understood for yourself, but what good does it do? The whole point of this work we're doing is to get beyond our own self-interest, be able to open ourselves, extend ourselves, and outgrow this narcissistic, deep narcissistic tendency we have to just take care of this one self. Here's another letter. Brave spirited wearers of the patch robe possess an outstanding, extraordinary aspect. With great determination, they give up conventional society. They look upon worldly status and evanescent fame as dust in the wind, as clouds floating by, as echoes in a valley. Since they already have great faculties and great capacity from the past, they know that this level exists, and they transcend birth and death and move beyond holy and ordinary. This is the indestructible true essence that all the enlightened ones of all times witness, the wondrous mind that alone the generations of enlightened teachers have communicated. This phrase, since they already have great faculties and great capacity from the past, they know that this level exists. It may be that he's referring to past lives as a result of having dedicated oneself to this Dharma through past lives. One knows in some inchoate way that we can know what we can aspire to, what is possible, the promise of practice. To tread this unique path, to be a fragrant elephant or a giant golden-winged bird, it is necessary to charge past the millions of categories and types and fly above them, to cut off the flow and brush against the heavens. How could the enlightened willingly be petty creatures, confined within distinctions of high and low and victory and defeat, trying futilely to make comparative judgments of instantaneous experience and being utterly turned around by gain and loss? Again, the warning to not get caught in discriminations of those who have awakened and those who haven't, those who are further in their practice than others, a notion of success and failure. These are deeply ingrained concepts in the mind and not easily uprooted. But so long as we have any such notions in the mind, then we are barred from the experience of seeing that which is beyond all such distinctions. For this reason, in olden times, the people of great enlightenment did not pay attention to trivial matters and did not aspire to the shallow and easily accessible. Here's another good warning for us. They did not pay attention to trivial matters. We have access to so much trivia now. Certainly the internet. One can while away all one's free time just surfing the web and picking through trivial stuff. Did not aspire to the shallow and easily accessible. My guess is that Yuan Wu, speaking from a place where when he refers to trivial matters, he really might include concern with the psychological and the philosophical. Naturally, there are We have some people have callings where they're drawn to certain things, and that could be philosophy or psychology. It could be a lot of other things. And he is addressing monks. Well, not entirely. We don't know who the recipient of this letter is. But to be aware of the certainty of death and the uncertainty of the time of death. This phrase would serve all of us well to keep in mind, the certainty of death and the uncertainty of the time of death. To have that as a true awareness is to be able to set priorities that don't favor trivialities. Harada Roshi, was Roshi Kaplow's first teacher in Japan. Had been a philosophy professor, actually, into quite, at least into middle age. And after he had been teaching for years, he referred to philosophy as the study of human delusion. Meaning the study of concepts. Ideas. But I always worry when I say this that people will think there's something wrong with it. It's, again, we have certain affinities, each one of us, and if that is something that we know that we love, that maybe that we're good at, then it can open doors for other people. That's how I got started. On the path through a philosophy course. The original definition of a philosopher is a seeker of truth. In that definition, all of us here are philosophers. But it can so easily deteriorate into just a lot of definitions, semantics, and just toying with ideas. They arouse their determination to transcend the Buddhas and patriarchs. Even we can become attached even to the notion of Buddha and the masters. They wanted to bear the heavy responsibility that no one can fully take up, to liberate all living beings, to remove suffering and bring peace, to smash the ignorance and blindness that obstructs the way. They wanted to break the poisonous arrows of ignorant folly and extract the thorns of arbitrary views from the eye of reality. They wanted to make the scenery of the fundamental ground clear and reveal the original face before the empty eon, before time. Time itself is a concept. Certain net of concepts that we have laid over reality, a construct of the human mind. So we have this koan from Japan. What was your face before your parents gave birth to you? Who were you before you were born? Who were you before your parents, your grandparents were born? What is the true self? You should train your mind and value actual practice wholeheartedly, exerting all your power, not shrinking from the cold or the heat. Go to the spot where you meditate and kill your mental monkey and slay your intellectual horse. Make yourself like a dead tree, like a withered stump. In other words, bring the mind back to its state of original stillness, unmarred by discriminations, back to this bottomless silence that is our nature. My teacher Wu Zhu often said, "I have been here for 5 decades and I've seen thousands and thousands of Zen followers come up to the corner of my meditation seat. They were all just seeking to become Buddhas and to expound Buddhism. I have never seen a single genuine wearer of the patched robe. Again, he's just warning about our grasping to find truth somewhere other than right here, to become something other than what we already are. How true this is, as we observe the present time, even those who expound Buddhism are hard to find, much less any genuine people. The age is in decline and the sages are further and further distant. In the whole great land of China, the lineage of Buddha is dying out right before our very eyes. We may find one person or half a person who is putting the Dharma into practice, but we would not dare to expect them to be like the great exemplars of enlightenment, the dragons and elephants of yore." You know, all through the history of Buddhism, you hear the masters lamenting that we live in a Dharma-ending age. We live at a time where the true Dharma is in jeopardy. And then, in case you're ready to slit your wrists, he says, Nevertheless, if you simply know the procedures and aims of practical application of the Dharma and carry on correctly from beginning to end, you are already producing a lotus from within the fire. So even, he says, with all of our defilements, our blind passions, our delusions, if we know how to do this practice, that's what he's really saying. And of course, everyone here does. Everyone's doing it. Then you are already in process of producing a lotus. You must put aside all the conditioning that entangles you. Then you will be able to perceive the inner content of the great enlightenment that has come down since ancient times. Be at rest wherever you are and carry on the secret, closely continuous, intimate level practice. The devas will have no road to strew flowers on, and demons and outsiders will not be able to find your tracks. This is what it means to truly leave home and thoroughly understand oneself. He probably is writing this letter to a monk with these references to leaving home. That's the English translation of the Chinese word for monk is a home leaver. He's referenced to the devas and the demons won't be able to track you. It's just reminding us of the kind of transparency that we can reach where we're not susceptible to falling into other states. When he enjoins us to put aside all the conditioning that entangles us, well, that's not just a lifetime of labor, that's lifetimes. Conditioning, this word conditioning covers a lot of ground. That's hundreds of lifetimes of pursuing the false. Thousands of lifetimes. But we can, in a moment of samadhi, moment of absolute absorption, of complete self-forgetfulness, we can experience freedom from that conditioning. Where the mind is wiped clean, where the original purity of our nature is restored, even if just for a few seconds. At that time, where is the conditioning? At such a time, we're free. In general, he continues, in general, to train on this path and seek out the mystery, you must have a great basis in faith. You use this faith to believe in a deep sense that this matter does not lie in words or in any of the myriad states of mind. In fact, in truth, the path is right where you stand. Must have a great basis in faith. Faith, most obviously, faith in practice. We have to have faith in practice to practice. But beyond that, faith in the luminous nature of our nature. Faith in our true nature, this Buddha mind. Faith in that which is beyond what we can know with our senses and our intellect. In the everyday work of Zazen, it means faith in the practice we're working on, the particular practice, the breath or the koan, whatever it is we're doing. Placing our faith there rather than in our thoughts. So long as we refuse to detach from our thoughts, that is, so long as we stubbornly continue to traffic in thoughts when we catch ourselves doing that, so long as we linger in our thoughts, then that's where our faith is, at least for that moment. We have to see what a sham the thoughts are, our thoughts are, how false they are, ultimately. It's not that there's no value to thinking incisively and using this amazing endowment of the discriminating mind that we share as human beings, but it won't bring any ultimate experience. To realize the nature of reality, we're not going to find it in thoughts. We have to be willing to pull away from the thoughts rather than continuing to let them wash over us. Faith also means faith in that which is beyond change, because it's not only thoughts that we can get entangled in. We can also get bogged down in emotional states and other states, as he says here, that this matter does not lie in words or in any of the myriad states of mind. This requires, in order not to get bogged down in states of mind, we have to notice when we are in a state of mind, any kind of emotional state or elevated state or other states. In a way, you could say that really Sesshin comes down to just moving through one mind state after another. And not trusting them, realizing right when we're having them, when we're in whatever state we're in, euphoric or angry or discouraged, that it's a mind state. It's a passing phenomenon. Faith in what is beyond change, beyond the flux that we experience in the body-mind complex. And then finally, put aside the crazy and false mind that has been concocting your knowledge and understanding, and make it so that nothing whatsoever is weighing on your mind. Fully take up this matter in your perfect, wondrous inherent nature, which is fundamentally pure and quiescent. Subject and object are both forgotten, and the road of words and thoughts is cut off. You open through and clearly see your original face. Make it so that once found, it is found forever and remains solid and unmoving. Time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.